And welcome to this audio edition of Philip Huscher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparella. Concerts by the CSO on Thursday, March 21st through Sunday, the 24th, feature guest conductor Susanna Melki, flute soloist Stefan Ragnar Hoskolsson, and soprano Ying Fang. The program includes the prelude to Act I of Wagner's Lohengrin. In its world premiere performances, Flute Concerto No. 2 by Lowell Lieberman, and after intermission, Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 4. Here are Philip Huscher's program notes on Lowell Lieberman's Flute Concerto No. 2, a work lasting about 20 minutes. Weeks after the triumphant premiere of Lowell Lieberman's highly engaging first flute concerto in St. Louis in the fall of 1992, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra gave the U.S. premiere of Continuo by the Italian avant-garde figurehead Luciano Berio. It was a watershed time for new music in this country, as giants of post-World War II modernism, such as Berio, were being faced with a new world of composers who would become known as neo-tonalists or neo-romantics or post-modernists, labels that did not begin to encompass the range of their richly expressive, highly personal music. It was necessary, they seemed to be saying, to move on to a new kind of musical language that was rooted in traditional tonality and no longer indebted to the strict academic systems, including serialism, they were being taught. For Lieberman, who quickly became one of the leading figures in this unnamed movement, the revelation came early in the 1980s when he was a piano and composition student at the Juilliard School. "I was studying Berio and Nono," he later recalled, "and learning to play the Boulez Second Sonata, and suddenly I said to myself, I'm really not enjoying this music." Once he found his own voice as a composer, Lieberman caused a stir both in serious academic circles, where his music was dismissed as reactionary, and with the general public, where he was enthusiastically admired. In 2002, when ABC correspondent Sam Donaldson asked Van Cliburn to list composers he liked from the past 100 years, the first name he mentioned was Lieberman. Lieberman's first flute concerto was the earliest work that stamped him as one of the leading composers who had graduated from the strictures of modernist thinking. In place of his self-consciously modern student works, "I felt pressure to stick wrong notes into a passage to make it sound modern or otherwise be accused of being old-fashioned," he began to write scores that embrace traditional forms and harmony. And he began to assign his pieces opus numbers, a largely outmoded gesture from the past. "It was a statement that I saw myself as part of the continuum of the Western classical tradition." It is a tradition Lieberman knows unusually well. At the Juilliard School, where he was a student from 1979 through 1987, earning bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees, he read through the school's entire library of scores, often at two pianos with a fellow composition student. "For a long, long time, Bach, for me, was the beginning and end of music," he has said. He was drawn to a large swath of music history, Britain, Copland, the late works of Shostakovich for their economy, Busoni for his rich harmonic language, and above all, Beethoven. It was his teacher, David Diamond, who insisted he study Beethoven's famous sketchbooks to see how the composer would take a tiny thematic idea and write dozens of variations on it as a form of creative discipline, and then insisted Lieberman keep his own sketchbooks as a kind of training ground. The language that Lieberman has made his own over the years brings all these resources together. Although he long ago rejected the pure 12-tone system, for example, he admits some of its central ideas into his music. His first opera, The Picture of Dorian Gray, given its U.S. premiere by the Florentine Opera Company in Milwaukee in 1999, is based on a 12-tone row. Each of its 12 scenes is written in the tonality of the consecutive pitches of the row. I like that kind of ambiguity of using a non-tonal theme to generate all this tonal music, he once said. Today, at Manus School of Music, at the New School in New York, where Lieberman teaches composition in a radically changed musical climate from the one he grew up in, his students know that tonality is no longer a suspect word. In 1987, Lieberman wrote a flute sonata that became highly popular, particularly after it was taken up by the renowned James Galway, inspiring a cluster of compositions, the First Flute Concerto of 1992, a concerto for flute and harp in 95, and a piccolo concerto in 1996. At first, Galway wanted Lieberman to orchestrate the sonata, but that idea turned into the flute concerto, which Galway premiered in St. Louis with Leonard Slatkin conducting. It soon became one of the most frequently performed concertos for flute in the repertory, joining the select company of those by Mozart and Nielsen, and it has been recorded some 20 times. Lieberman has since written many concertos for flute, piano, clarinet, cello, trumpet, and most recently organ, premiered in September with Paul Jacobs and the Jacksonville Symphony. But it has taken more than 3 decades for him to come around to composing a second flute concerto. The Flute Concerto No. 2, which is having its premiere this week, grew out of Lieberman's acquaintance with Stefan Ragnar Höskason while he was principal flute of the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra, a position he left in 2016 to come to Chicago. Over time, the idea of a new flute concerto began to take shape, resulting finally in the commission from the Chicago Symphony. In 1992, when people did not know what to make of Lieberman's unexpected musical style, they could only judge his music against other earlier composers. It was regularly said that the opening of the First Flute Concerto sounded like Prokofiev. Now, as perhaps the greatest evidence that we live in a fresh new musical world, one where Lieberman's music is regularly performed and admired, Lieberman simply sounds like himself. And here is Lowell Lieberman himself on his Flute Concerto No. 2. I have had the pleasure and honor of counting Stefan Ragnar Höskason as a colleague and friend for many years now. During that time, I have had the joy of hearing him perform many of my works. He made a superlative recording of my sonata for flute and piano and premiered my air for flute and orchestra at Carnegie Hall with the New York Youth Symphony. It was something of a dream for both of us that I would one day write a new concerto for Stefan, so when he called to say that the CSO would commission it, I was absolutely thrilled. Like my first flute concerto, the second concerto is in 3 movements, but in this case, the second and third movements are performed without break. Like most of my music, it has no programmatic or extra-musical inspiration. It is simply about the notes and the abstract emotions that they evoke in the listener. Words by Lowell Lieberman and program notes by Philip Huscher on Lieberman's Flute Concerto No. 2. And now on to Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 4, a work lasting about 55 minutes. The worlds of song and symphony are regularly intertwined in the work of Gustav Mahler. We are not surprised when his symphonies break into song, and we know that certain purely instrumental movements are arrangements of earlier songs. One of his last works, Das Lied von der Erde, is indeed both song and symphony, the inevitable climax of a career that continually shuffled and blended genres in its search for the ideal form to say what Mahler alone had to tell us. Still, it is hard to understand how one small song, Das himmlische Leben, Heavenly Life, the one that serves as the finale for this symphony, can have inspired, influenced, and shaped so much important music. At one point, Mahler remarked that Das himmlische Leben had given birth to 5 different symphonic movements, but even that statement doesn't suggest the central role the song played in his output over the span of a decade. Although it is the last music we hear in the symphony, the song was Mahler's starting point. We must first turn to Achim von Arnim and Clemens Brentano, who in the early years of the 19th century published an anthology of 700 traditional German poems known as Des Knaben Wunderhorn, the youth's magic horn. Karl Maria von Weber was one of the first composers to see the musical potential of this collection, and by coincidence, it was his copy of the Wunderhorn poems that Mahler picked up one day in 1887 while he was visiting the home of the composer's grandson. Although it was the grandson's lovely wife, Marion, who captured Mahler's attention that year, this book of old folk poetry had the more lasting impact. He picked a few poems and set them to music at once. For the next 14 years, Mahler used Des Knaben Wunderhorn as the source for all but one of his song texts. On February 10, 1892, he completed a setting for voice and piano of the poem Der Himmel hängt voll Geigen, Heaven is hung with violins, a child's naive picture of celestial bliss. Mahler wrote his own title, Das himmlische Leben, at the top of the page. A month later, he finished the orchestral version colored by the sounds of a harp and the tinkling of bells. Mahler had a special affection for the song, and he often included it in his concerts of his music. But when it came time to publish his Wunderhorn settings, Das himmlische Leben was held back. Mahler had decided to use the song as the finale of his third symphony instead. The rest of that symphony was conceived as a sequence of answers to life's questions, concluding with What the Child Tells Me, or Das himmlische Leben. But as the work neared completion, Mahler lopped off the finale and carried it with him to his next symphony. However, one can easily find music in the symphony that predicts and prepares us for the song that is no longer there. The fifth movement, for example, another Wunderhorn text scored for children's voices, originally was intended as a companion piece to Das himmlische Leben, and it comes from the same world of angels and bells. And so, it became the role of the fourth symphony to finish the story of the third. That now meant placing Das himmlische Leben as the last chapter of the fourth symphony, the finale not of one, but in a sense, of two symphonies. However, to think of the fourth as a sequel to the third is to limit our understanding of two works related in complex ways. Mahler's fourth symphony, like all his major scores, reflects and draws on other music he was writing around the same time. The fourth symphony not only looks back at the third, but glances ahead at the Kindertotenlieder, the five Rückert songs, and the opening of the fifth symphony. These are all members of an extended family, and each casts its own shadow on the others. In planning his fourth symphony, much more so than the third, Mahler relied on Das himmlische Leben as the governing material, both of the music and of the overall idea, the story behind the notes in the score. Mahler knew how this piece would end before he wrote his first page, and then had to work backwards, in a sense, so that his song would appear as the logical destination of the three new movements. With this goal in sight, he conceived a symphony that would explore the road from experience to innocence, from complexity to simplicity, and from earthly life to heaven. The symphony, like his previous three, was never saddled with an explanatory text that the composer would later regret and ultimately suppress. Mahler was already moving toward an inner drama that could be expressed exclusively in musical terms. To convey the journey toward innocence, Mahler's first three movements gradually diminish in complexity as they approach the pure and serene threshold of the finale. The key scheme also supports the drama, beginning in G major and then moving into the fresh world of E major for the finale, an unexpected yet preordained destination. Mahler suggests his goal with the symphony's very opening bars, scored for the sleigh bells and piping flutes that will later greet us in heaven. In a work full of flashbacks and flash forwards, this is a momentary glance and no more. Mahler quickly introduces a lovely melody, childishly simple and quite unselfconscious, in his own words, that, like many simple materials in music, will lead to the most complex developments. The movement is one of Mahler's most brilliant large-scale canvases, a perfect foil to the naivete of the ending. Here, Mahler is writing with a newfound clarity, a transparency that allows us to hear everything on the page, even in the most complex polyphonic passages. The climaxes are still dense and staggering, despite the smallest orchestra of any Mahler symphony, but the surrounding landscape is lean and exposed. At the movement's turning point, events unfold almost too quickly to follow. There is a snatch of the song of heavenly life. The trumpet suggests the march we now know from the Fifth Symphony. The symphony's opening melody returns unexpectedly, and the recapitulation begins before the development is even over. Mahler has compressed time in a way that is virtually new to music. The childishly simple melody, left hanging by a thread, now continues as if undisturbed. Although Mahler left no titles for the movements in the symphony, fearing their banal misunderstandings, we know that the second movement originally was inscribed "Friend Hein Strikes Up," after a character of German folklore, a sinister Pied Piper who plays his violin and leads his victims toward death. Mahler assigns the central role to the solo violin, instructs him to tune his instrument up a whole tone to give it a harsher sound, and to play it wie ein Fiedel, like the fiddle one knows from the street, not the concert hall. The two Landler-like trios hint at the music of Das himmlische Leben to come. Mahler once admitted that the slow movement, a spacious and magnificent set of variations, was inspired by a vision of a tombstone on which was carved an image of the departed with folded arms in eternal sleep. There is one immense uproar near the end that would surely raise the dead, however, and when this great wave erupts from G major and plants us for the first time squarely in E major, the gates of heaven are within sight, but first we sink back into G major to await the song from which this music first sprang. And then, with a few bucolic phrases from the winds and the gentle plucking of the harp and strings, we hear the human voice for the first time in this symphony. A soprano sings of an innocent pastoral world, and Mahler's pen sketches cloudless blue skies and the eternity of E major. Angels bake bread, the singer reports. St. Peter fishes in a pond stocked daily by God. And there is no music at all on the earth which can ever compare with ours. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 4. My name is Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.